readers, welcome to the spooktacular edition of the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and with Halloween right around the corner, my treat is to present you with a cauldron full of dark, eerie, mystical, and magical books. Some are on the bestseller list right now, and some are classics of yore, which you're gonna love. So settle in and let the titles bewitch you as we turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need MagicBuzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The MagicBuzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. MagicBuzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz, we're there when you can't be.
The circus arrives without warning. No announcements precede it. It is simply there, when yesterday it was not. The striped canvas tents hold an utterly unique experience full of breathtaking amazements. In The Night Circus, a brilliant debut by Aaron Morgenstern, a fierce competition is underway. A duel between two young magicians, Celia and Marco, trained since childhood expressly for this purpose by their mercurial instructors. Unbeknownst to them, this is a game where only one can be left standing, and the circus is but the stage for a remarkable battle of imagination and will. Despite all, Celia and Marco fall in love, a deep, magical love that makes the lights flicker and the room grow warm whenever they so much as brush hands. True love or not, the game must play out, and the fates of everyone involved, from the cast of the circus performers to the patrons, hang in the balance, suspended as precariously as the acrobats overhead. Jim Dale narrates.
First, there is a popping sound. It is barely audible over the wind and conversation, a soft noise like a kettle about to boil for tea. Then comes the light. All over the tents, small lights begin to flicker, as though the entirety of the circus is covered in particularly bright fireflies. The waiting crowd quiets as it watches this display of illumination. Someone near you gasps. A small child claps his hands with glee at the sight. When the tents are all aglow, sparkling against the night sky, the sign appears. Stretched across the top of the gates, hidden in curls of iron, more firefly-like lights flicker to life. They pop as they brighten, some accompanied by a shower of glowing white sparks and a bit of smoke. The people nearest to the gates take a few steps back. At first, it is only a random pattern of lights, but as more of them ignite, it becomes clear that they are aligned in scripted letters. First, a C is distinguishable, followed by more letters. A Q, oddly, and several E's. When the final bulb pops alight and the smoke and sparks dissipate, it is finally legible, this elaborate incandescent sign. Leaning to your left to gain a better view, you can see that it reads, Le Cirque des Rêves. Some in the crowd smile knowingly, while others frown and look questioningly at their neighbors. A child near you tugs on her mother's sleeve, begging to know what it says. The Circus of Dreams, comes the reply. The girl smiles delightedly. Then the iron gates shudder and unlock, seemingly by their own volition. They swing outward, inviting the crowd inside. Now the circus is open. Now you may enter. Part 1. Primordium. The whole of Le Cirque des Rêves is formed by a series of circles. Perhaps it is a tribute to the origin of the word circus, deriving from the Greek kirkos, meaning circle or ring. There are many such nods to the phenomenon of the circus in a historical sense, though it is hardly a traditional circus. Rather than a single tent with rings enclosed within, this circus contains clusters of tents like pyramids, some large and others quite small. They are set within circular paths, contained within a circular fence, looping and continuous. Friedrich Thiessen, 1892. A dreamer is one who can only find his way by moonlight, and his punishment is that he sees the dawn before the rest of the world. Oscar Wilde, 1888. Unexpected Post. New York, February 1873. The man billed as Prospero the Enchanter receives a fair amount of correspondence via the theatre office, but this is the first envelope addressed to him that contains a suicide note, and it is also the first to arrive carefully pinned to the coat of a 5-year-old girl. The lawyer who escorts her to the theatre refuses to explain, despite the manager's protestations, abandoning her as quickly as he can with no more than a shrug and the tip of a hat. The theatre manager does not need to read the envelope to know who the girl is for. The bright eyes peering out from under a cloud of unruly brown curls are smaller, wider versions of the magician's own. He takes her by the hand, her small fingers hanging limp within his. She refuses to remove her coat, despite the warmth of the theatre, giving only an adamant shake of her head when he asks her why. The manager takes the girl to his office, not knowing what else to do with her. She sits quietly on an uncomfortable chair beneath a line of framed posters advertising past productions, surrounded by boxes of tickets and receipts. The manager brings her a cup of tea with an extra lump of sugar, but it remains on the desk, untouched, and grows cold. The girl does not move, does not fidget in her seat. She stays perfectly still with her hands folded in her lap. Her gaze is fixed downward, focused on her boots that do not quite touch the floor.
Readers, it wouldn't be Halloween without a creepy classic from Stephen King. I chose this title because, hey, I'm always hoping to lose a pound or two. So, may I present to you Thinner. 6 weeks after an old gypsy man curses Billy Halleck, an overweight attorney, for sideswiping his daughter, Billy is 93 pounds lighter. Small-town corruption allowed Billy to walk away with just a slap on the wrist, but the patriarch of the gypsy clan cursed Billy with his own form of justice. Billy is terrified and desperate enough for one last gamble, one that will lead him to a nightmare showdown with the forces of evil that are melting his flesh away. Joe Mantegna's performance is one you'll remember.
She slipped into the seat opposite him in the breakfast nook and lit a Vantage 100. January and February had been tense. Too many discussions that were only disguised arguments. Too many nights they had finished sleeping back to back. But they had reached the modus vivendi. She had stopped dunning him about his weight, and he had stopped yapping at her about her pack-and-a-half-a-day butt habit. It had made for a decent enough spring, and beyond their own private balance, other good things had happened. Halleck had been promoted, for one. Greeley, Pensley, and Kinder was now Greeley, Pensley, Kinder, and Halleck. Heidi's mother had finally made good on her long-standing threat to move back to Virginia. Linda had at last made JV cheerleaders, and to Billy this was a great blessing. There had been times when he had been sure Lynn's histrionics would drive him into a nervous breakdown. Everything had been going just great. Then The gypsies had come to town.
"Thinner,"
the old gypsy man had said. And what the hell was it with his nose? Syphilis? Cancer? Or something even more terrible like leprosy? And by the way, why can't you just quit it? Why can't you just let it alone? "You can't get it off your mind, can you?" Heidi said suddenly, so suddenly that Halleck started in his seat. "Billy, it was not your fault." "The judge said so." "I wasn't thinking about that." "Then what were you thinking about?" "The journal," he said. "It says housing starts are down again this quarter." Not his fault, right. The judge had said so. Judge Rossington. Carrie to his friends. Friends like me, Halleck thought. Played many a round of golf with old Carrie Rossington, Heidi, as you well know. At our New Year's Eve party 2 years ago, the year I thought about giving up smoking and didn't do it. Who grabbed your oh-so-grabbable during the traditional Happy New Year kiss? Guess who? Why, my stars, it was good old Carrie Rossington, as I live and breathe. Yes, good old Carrie Rossington, before whom Billy had argued more than a dozen municipal cases. Good old Carrie Rossington, with whom Billy sometimes played poker down at the club. Good old Carrie Rossington, who hadn't disqualified himself when his good old golfing and poker buddy Billy Halleck... Carrie would sometimes clap him on the back and yell, "How they hanging, Big Bill?" came before him in court, not to argue some point of municipal law, but on a charge of vehicular manslaughter. And when Carrie Rossington did not disqualify himself, who said boo, children? Who in this whole fair town of Fairview was the boo-sayer? Why, nobody. That's who. Nobody said boo. After all, what were they? Nothing but a bunch of filthy gypsies. The sooner they were out of Fairview and headed up the road in their old station wagons with the NRA stickers on the back bumpers, the sooner we saw the rear ends of their home carpentered trailers and camper caps, the better. The sooner, the thinner. Heidi snuffed her cigarette and said, "On your housing starts. I know you better." Billy supposed so, and he supposed she had been thinking about it too. Her face was too pale. She looked her age, 35, and that was rare. They had married very, very young, and he still remembered the traveling salesman who'd come to the door selling vacuum cleaners one day after they had been married 3 years. He had looked at the 22-year-old Heidi Halleck and had asked politely, "Is your mother home, hon?" "Not hurting my appetite any," he said, and that was certainly true. Angst or no angst, he had lain waste to the scrambled eggs, and of the bacon there was now no sign. He drank half his orange juice and gave her a big old Billy Halleck grin. She tried to smile back, and it didn't quite happen. He imagined her wearing a sign, "My smiler is temporarily out of order." He reached across the table and took her hand. "Heidi, it's all right. And even if it's not, it's all over." "I know it is. I know." "Is Linda..." "No, not anymore. She says her girlfriends are being very supportive." For about a week after it happened, their daughter had had a bad time of it. She had come home from school either in tears or close to them.
Rice, the Queen of the Vampires, writes a metaphysical thriller about angels and assassins. Angel Time, the Songs of the Seraphim, opens in the present. At its center, Toby O'Dare, a contract killer of underground fame on an assignment to kill again. A soulless soul, a dead man walking, he lives under a series of aliases. Just now, Lucky the Fox, and takes his order from the right man. Into O'Dare's nightmarish world of lone, lethal missions comes a mysterious stranger, a seraph, who offers him a chance to save rather than destroy lives. Odaire, who long ago dreamt of being a priest but instead came to embody danger and violence, seizes his chance. He is carried back through the ages to 13th century England, to dark realms where accusations of ritual murder have been made against the Jews, and children suddenly die or disappear. In this primitive setting, Odaire begins his perilous quest for salvation, a journey of danger and flight, loyalty and betrayal, selflessness and love. The title is narrated by Paul Michael.
There were omens from the beginning. First off, I didn't want to do a job at the Mission Inn. Anywhere in the country I would have been willing, but not the Mission Inn. And in the bridal suite, that very room. My room. Bad luck and beyond, I thought to myself. Of course, my boss, the right man, had no way of knowing when he gave me this assignment that the Mission Inn was where I went when I didn't want to be Lucky the Fox, when I didn't want to be his assassin. The Mission Inn was part of that very small world in which I wore no disguise. I was simply me when I went there. 6'4", short blonde hair, gray eyes. A person who looked like so many other people that he didn't look like any special person at all. I didn't even bother to wear braces to disguise my voice when I went there. I didn't even bother with the de rigueur sunglasses that shielded my identity in every other place, except the apartment and neighborhood where I lived. I was just who I am when I went there. Though, who I am was nobody except the man who wore all those elaborate disguises when he did what he was told to do by the right man. So the Mission Inn was mine, cipher that I was, and so was the bridal suite, called the Amistad Suite, under the dome. And now I was being told to systematically pollute it. Not for anyone else but myself, of course. I would never have done anything to harm the Mission Inn. A giant confection and confabulation of a building in Riverside, California, it was where I often took refuge, an extravagant and engulfing place sprawling over two city blocks, and where I could pretend, for a day or two or three, that I wasn't wanted by the FBI, Interpol, or the right man. A place where I could lose myself and my conscience. Europe had long ago become unsafe for me, due to the increased security at every checkpoint, and the fact that the law enforcement agencies that dreamed of trapping me had decided I was behind every single unsolved murder they had on the books. If I wanted the atmosphere I'd loved so much in Siena or Assisi or Vienna or Prague, and all the other places I could no longer visit, I sought out the Mission Inn. It couldn't be all those places, no. Yet it gave me a unique haven and sent me back out into my sterile world, a renewed spirit. It wasn't the only place where I wasn't anybody at all, but it was the best place, and the place to which I went the most. The Mission Inn was not far from where I lived, if one could call it that, and I went there on impulse generally, and at any time that they could give me my suite. I liked the other rooms all right, especially the innkeeper's suite. But I was patient in waiting for the Amistad. And sometimes they called me on one of the many special cell phones I carried to let me know the suite could be mine. Sometimes I stayed as long as a week in the Mission Inn. I'd bring my lute with me and maybe play it a little. And I always had a stack of books to read, almost always history, books on medieval times or the Dark Ages or the Renaissance or ancient Rome. I'd read for hours in the Amistad, feeling uncommonly safe and secure. There were special places I went from the inn. Often undisguised, I drove over to nearby Costa Mesa to hear the Pacific Symphony. I liked it, the contrast, moving from the stucco arches and rusted bells of the inn to the immense plexiglass miracle of the Segerstrom Concert Hall with the pretty Café Rouge on the first floor. Behind those high, clear, undulating windows, the restaurant appeared to float in space. I felt, when I dined in it, that I was indeed floating in space and in time, detached from all things ugly and evil, and sweetly alone. I had just recently heard Stravinsky's Rite of Spring in that concert hall. Loved it. Loved the pounding madness of it. It had brought back a memory of the very first time I'd ever heard it, 10 years before, on the night when I'd met the right man. It had made me think of my own life and all that had happened since then, as I'd drifted through the world waiting for those cell phone calls that always meant somebody was marked, and I had to get him. I never killed women, but that's not to say that I hadn't before I became the right man's vassal or serf or knight, depending on how one chose to view it. He called me his knight. I thought of it in far more sinister terms, and nothing during these 10 years had ever accustomed me to my function.
Phillips Lovecraft is among the greatest American writers of fantasy and the supernatural. I'm shamefaced to say I had not heard about him until Dave, my sound engineer, recommended him for this Halloween show. Lovecraft was born in 1890 in Providence, Rhode Island. Because his health was uncertain from childhood, he led a sheltered life. He read voraciously. As a shy, imaginative child, he began to invent a macabre fantasy world of his own, peopled by creatures from his own weird imagination. As an adult, Lovecraft was almost a recluse. He was given to wandering his native city in the dark hours of the night and became a devoted student of its antiquities. Many of his stories are set around the imaginary town of Arkham. He invented an entire mythology, its core being a demonic cult based on the legend that the world was at one time inhabited by another race who, in practicing black magic, were expelled. Yet, they live outside, ever ready to take possession of the earth again. Since Lovecraft's early death in 1937, his stories have grown in popularity. He's hailed as an influence behind Wes Craven and Stephen King, just to name a few. The Dark Worlds of H.P. Lovecraft, Volume 1, is a collection of his best-known tales and is narrated by Wayne June.
Across a covered bridge, one sees a small village huddled between the stream and the vertical slope of Round Mountain, and wonders at the cluster of rotting gambrel roofs bespeaking an earlier architectural period than that of the neighboring region. It is not reassuring to see, on a closer glance, that most of the houses are deserted and falling to ruin, and that the broken steepled church now harbors the one slovenly mercantile establishment of the hamlet. One dreads to trust the tenebrous tunnel of the bridge, yet there is no way to avoid it. Once across, it is hard to prevent the impression of a faint, malign odor about the village street, as of the massed mold and decay of centuries. It is always a relief to get clear of the place and to follow the narrow road around the base of the hills and across the level country beyond till it rejoins the Aylesbury Pike. Afterwards, one sometimes learns that one has been through Dunwich. Outsiders visit Dunwich as seldom as possible, and since a certain season of horror, all the signboards pointing towards it have been taken down. The scenery, judged by an ordinary aesthetic canon, is more than commonly beautiful, yet there is no influx of artists or summer tourists. 2 centuries ago, when talk of witch blood, Satan worship, and strange forest presences was not laughed at, it was the custom to give reasons for avoiding the locality. In our sensible age, since the Dunwich horror of 1928 was hushed up by those who had the town's and the world's welfare at heart, people shun it without knowing exactly why. Perhaps one reason, though it cannot apply to uninformed strangers, is that the natives are now repellently decadent, having gone far beyond that path of retrogression so common in many New England backwaters. They have come to form a race by themselves, with the well-defined mental and physical stigmata of degeneracy and inbreeding. The average of their intelligence is woefully low, whilst their annals reek of overt viciousness and of half-hidden murders, incests, and deeds of almost unnameable violence and perversity. The old gentry, representing the two or three armigerous families which came from Salem in 1692, have kept somewhat above the general level of decay, though many branches are sunk into the sordid populace so deeply that only their names remain as a key to the origin they disgrace. Some of the Whateleys and bishops still send their eldest sons to Harvard and Miskatonic, though those sons seldom return to the moldering gambrel roofs under which they and their ancestors were born. No one, even those who have the facts concerning the recent horror, can say just what is the matter with Dunwich, though old legends speak of unhallowed rites and conclaves of the Indians, amidst which they called forbidden shapes of shadow out of the great rounded hills, and made wild, orgiastic prayers that were answered by loud crackings and rumblings from the ground below.
Doug Bradley's Spine Chillers, Volume 8, takes you into the world of classic short horror stories read by Hollywood horror icons. Ooh, it doesn't get any spookier than this. Famous authors included in the collection are Edgar Allan Poe, Arthur Conan Doyle, and again, H.P. Lovecraft. Doug Bradley and Jeff Combs narrate this Halloween perfect collection.
A Warning to the Curious by M.R. James. In another moment, Paxton was out of the hole again and busy shoveling back the soil with hands that were already bleeding. He would have none of our help, though. It was much the longest part of the job to get the place to look undisturbed, yet I don't know how he made a wonderful success of it. At last, he was satisfied, and we turned back. We were a couple of hundred yards from the hill when Long suddenly said to him, "I say, you've left your coat there. That won't do. See?" I certainly did see it. The long, dark overcoat lying where the tunnel had been. Paxton had not stopped, however. He only shook his head and held up the coat on his arm. And when we joined him, he said, without any excitement, but as if nothing mattered anymore, "That wasn't my coat." And indeed, when we looked back again, that dark thing was not to be seen. Herbert West, Reanimator, by H.P. Lovecraft.
When from the pitch-black room we had left, there burst the most appalling and demoniac succession of cries that either of us had ever heard. Not more unutterable could have been the chaos of hellish sound if the pit itself had opened to release the agony of the damned. For in one inconceivable cacophony was centered all the supernal terror and unnatural despair of animate nature. Human, it could not have been.
Our guest today is award-winning author Michael Thomas Barry. Michael lives in Orange County, California. At university, he took degrees in both criminal justice and history. He's worked at various times as a peace officer in Orange County and as a private sector corporate asset protection specialist. Today, we're going to speak to Michael about his second book, Fade to Black, Graveside Memories of Hollywood Greats, 1927 to 1950. It chronicles the lives, deaths, and final resting places of the actors, actresses, and directors who won Academy Awards during Hollywood's golden age. Featured are Clark Gable, Bette Davis, Spencer Tracy, Ethel Barrymore, and Katharine Hepburn, just to list a few. Welcome, Michael. Great to have you with us for our Halloween edition.
Thanks for having me today, Elaine.
Okay, what made you decide to write the book Fade to Black?
Well, first and foremost, I'm a big fan of the old classic movies from the 30s and 40s. And basically, it came about from a lifetime of watching these movies. And while I was writing my first book in 2009, Final Resting Places, Orange County's Dead and Famous, I found myself lingering at the grave, one of the most famous graves here in Orange County, which was John Wayne. And at that point, I started wondering about some of the other lives of some of the other legendary actors from that golden age of Hollywood. And I thought at first I'd write a volume about all the actors, but obviously that would have been a monumental task. So I decided to pare down the idea to encompass only the Oscar winners from 1927 to 1950.
Okay. And I thought that the book was organized in a great way. Share a little bit with our listeners about that.
Well, Fade to Black is a tribute to Hollywood history as told through the first 23 years of the Academy Awards ceremony. Basically, I take the reader behind the scenes of each award ceremony and the history behind the creation of the awards, 1927, through the rise of television and the decline of the studio system in 1950. Basically, I examined, obviously, each Oscar ceremony, telling the electrifying true stories of each Oscar-winning actor, actress, and director, and I also include the supporting actor and actress as well. What I do is I tell about their extraordinary and sometimes shocking lives, their film careers, their deaths, and obviously it culminates in where they're buried at. Basically, I their stories unfold through short and concise biographies. I throw in some trivia and quotes, and I've also included over 100 rare photographs of the stars and their resting places.
Yeah. You know, I guess I enjoyed reading it. I always thought that Katharine Hepburn was British. In my mind, she always had that upper-class English accent, and she was born in New England, correct?
Right. She was very haughty in her style, but, yeah, she's originally from Connecticut, born and raised, and she's also buried there with her parents in Connecticut. Bette Davis and Joan Crawford and their ongoing feud, I knew a little bit about it, but going in, I found out how much they really, really hated each other.
Right.
Which was sometimes kind of humorous, but they really were serious about it.
And I know that you you have something in the book about when Bette Davis found out that Joan Crawford had died, or was it the other way around? Tell us that quote.
Right. When Joan Crawford died, Bette Davis made the offhanded quote that, you know, and she never said anything about the dead, Joan Crawford is dead, good.
Right.
So it's kind of very, very catty, but that kind of capsulized their relationship. Although in the end of their later career, they actually starred together in a few movies, some more famous movies, but very contentious, and they were very, very jealous of each other's career.
Yeah. And speaking of Bette Davis, I enjoyed her epitaph, Bette Davis, April 5th, 1908, October 6, 1989, she did it the hard way. Can you tell us some of the other memorable epitaphs you came across?
Yeah, I have a few. Mary Pickford, one of the stars of basically the silent era towards the end of the beginning of the talkies. Her tomb is at Forest Lawn Glendale. It's locked behind an private garden, so basically you can't get in there to see unless you have a key or know somebody or whatever. But she died in 1989, and her epitaph is that she was America's sweetheart, and she basically was.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a very ornate tomb, just like Bette Davis. And probably the two of them are probably close, one and two, as far as in my favorites. Wallace Beery is another actor from the 1930s. He died in 1949, and it's probably my most, the epitaph that I like the most. And it basically, it's very simple. It says, "No man is indispensable, but some are irreplaceable." Very, very short and sweet, but it's very poignant as well. Another is Billy Wilder, the director-writer from Lost Weekend, The Apartment, The Seven-Year Itch, Some Like It Hot. He's buried at Westwood Memorial Park, the same place where Marilyn Monroe is. And his epitaph reads, "I'm a writer, but nobody's perfect." And it's short and sweet, no dates, just his name. And those are the ones that stick out the most. But for the most part, I found that the stars' graves were quite plain and unassuming. Most of the time, you wouldn't have any idea, unless you knew where you're going or who they were, what their careers were, about what they did in life.
Right.
Which was kind of shocking to me. Going there, traveling to as many as I could, I was expecting, you know, what I was expecting and what I found was very disappointing, in the fact that, you know, these legends of the silver screen, we've built them up, and you go there, it's kind of, like I said, kind of underwhelming.
Yeah. Well, okay, so when people go to Paris, everybody goes to Père Lachaise and sees Jim Morrison's grave. If you go out to Hollywood, is there one graveyard that, you know, most people would go to and to see a lot of stars?
Well, the place that's the most fan-friendly would obviously be Hollywood Forever Cemetery in Hollywood. It hands down is the most fan-friendly. They're very open and endorse fans to come. You can actually go into their gift shop and buy a map. You have no hassles there, where people, you know, if they want to take pictures, want to linger, want to be in a group, whatever, they're very, very open to it. They actually, during the summers, they actually have movies that they show in the cemetery. So they definitely openly embrace their Hollywood history. And there's many, many Hollywood people buried there, famous people, infamous people. So that would be the one that's first and foremost in my mind. A second would be in New York, which would be Ferncliff Cemetery in Hartsdale, and that's where Judy Garland and Joan Crawford are buried. They also embrace their history. On their website, they list all the famous people that are interred there. But off the top of my head, those are the two that I would visit first if I was on the East Coast or West Coast. The one I'd stay away from the most would be the Forest Lawn.
Has any star's funeral ever surpassed that of Rudolph Valentino, where they said that more than 100,000 people were estimated to have filed past? Is there another more recent star that had, you know, the funeral of the huge magnitude?
The only one that would come even close, and there's really nobody close to Valentino's, would be Judy Garland. When she died in 1969, her funeral was held in New York, and over 20,000 people paid their respects to the funeral home there. So as far as magnitude, obviously Valentino's in a league by himself. And then most recently, obviously Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson
would probably be the one in the most recent history. But those three, I think, have evoked the most visitors, I would say.
Well, as this is Halloween time, are there tales of any hauntings or sightings at any of the grave sites?
You know, that's something I didn't focus in on the book, and, you know, I'm not really sure. I'm sure there is. Cemeteries always seem to invoke, you know, in people's imaginations. But as I was going through, I didn't really focus anything on that, and I don't really have any stories. I wish I did, because I love hearing about those things too. But there were some creepy situations when I was out in New York Sleepy Hollow Cemetery, Irvin Washington's. The Headless Horseman, Alice Brady's buried there, not too far from Headless Horseman Bridge. So that was, in a way, obviously, a ghost story. It was obviously fabricated, but it was actually, the atmosphere was very, very creepy. Rainy day, rainy Sunday morning. It was definitely eerie in its own right.
Hmm. Well, are there any, like, annual visitations to graves, kind of like, again, Valentino, where the woman in the black dress is carrying a red rose? Are there any, you know, annual events at any of the stars' graves?
Well, obviously, Valentino, he died in 1926, and every year since that death, there's been a long list of women up until this day who still arrive and dressed in black, and they leave their rose and whatnot. It's very dramatic. You know, as far as that, there's, I don't know any other stories other than when the birthdays and anniversaries of their death, most of these stars, you can go to any of their graves, and there will always be some kind of memento left. There wasn't a time when I didn't go to any of these, and there wasn't something there. But obviously, Valentino is the one that's most famous. There's nobody else that I can, off the top of my head, think of that has the same kind of a annual respect, other than the fact that most of them are definitely remembered.
Hmm. Okay, so what's your next project? Are you going to continue on in this kind of ghoulish vein, or what?
My next book, which will be coming out in early 2012, is definitely a switch from the graveyard book telling. It's called Murder and Mayhem, 52 Crimes That Shocked Early California.
I loved your book. Where can readers find it? Is it in most bookstores or online, or how can they get it?
You can find it in both, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can find it online. If you go into the bookstores, if they don't have it, you can order it. You can go to my website, michaelthomasberry.com, and that's Berry with an A. I also have links there as well. So basically, they can go anywhere, internet, they can go to the bookstores, and it's available everywhere.
Oh, all right. Well, thanks so much, Michael. It's a great book to read for Halloween, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Elaine.
All righty. Bye.
Bye-bye.
In Dan Simmons' Carrion Comfort, Saul Lasky seems destined to die in one of Hitler's extermination camps. When he rises to meet his fate, though, he finds himself face to face with an evil far older and far greater than the Nazis. Saul begins a journey that spans decades and crosses continents. He plunges into the darkest corners of 20th century history to reveal a secret society of beings who, throughout the ages, existed behind the world's most horrible and violent events. Killing from a distance and by darkly manipulative proxy, they are people with the psychic ability to use humans, read their minds, subjugate their wills, feed off their emotions, force them to acts of unspeakable aggression. Each year, three of the most powerful of this hidden order meet to discuss their triumphs of bloodshed and destruction. But at this reunion, something will go terribly wrong. Saul's quest is about to reach its elusive object, drawing hunter and hunted alike into a struggle that will plumb the depths of mankind's attraction to violence and determine the future of the world itself. Mel Foster and Laurel Merlington narrate.
The Pit. Saul had seen the pit. With the others, he had shoveled cold clods of black soil over the warm bodies, some still writhing, a child feebly moving its arm as if waving to a welcoming relative in a train station or stirring in its sleep, shoveled the dirt and spread the lime from bags too heavy to lift, while the SS guard sat dangling his legs over the edge of the pit. His hands, soft and white on the black steel barrel of the machine pistol, a piece of plaster on his rough cheek where he had cut himself shaving, the cut already healing, while naked white forms stirred feebly as Saul poured dirt into the pit, his eyes red-rimmed from the cloud of lime hanging like a chalky fog in the winter air. I will live. Saul concentrated on the strength of that cadence, and ignored his shaking limbs. Two levels above him, a man sobbed in the night. Saul could feel the lice crawling up his arms and legs as they sought the center of his fading warmth. He curled into a tighter ball, understanding the imperative which drove the vermin, responding to the same mindless, illogical, incontestable command to continue. The stone dropped deeper into the azure depths. Saul could make out the rough letters as he balanced on the edge of sleep. I will live. Saul's eyes snapped open as a thought chilled him more deeply than did the wind whistling through the ill-fitted window frames. It was the third Thursday of the month. Saul was almost sure it was the third Thursday. They came on the third Thursday. But not always. Perhaps not this Thursday. Saul pulled his forearms in front of his face and curled into an even tighter fetal position. He was almost asleep when the barracks door crashed open. There were five of them, two Waffen SS guards with submachine guns, a regular army non-com, Lieutenant Schaffner, and a young Oberst whom Saul had never seen before. The Oberst had a pale Aryan face with a strand of blonde hair falling across his brow. Their hand torches played over the rows of shelf-like bunks. Not a man stirred. Saul could feel the silence as 85 skeletons held their breath in the night. He held his breath. The Germans took five strides into the barracks, the cold air billowing ahead of them, their massive forms silhouetted against the open door, while their breath hung in icy clouds around them. Saul pulled himself even deeper into the brittle straw. "Du!" came the voice. The torch beam had fallen on a capped and striped figure crouched in the depths of a lower bunk six rows from Saul. Komm, schnell! When the man did not move, the SS guards dragged him roughly into the aisle. Saul heard bare feet scraping on the floor. Du, raus! And again, du! Now three Muscle-Men are stood like weightless scarecrows before the massive silhouettes. The procession stopped four bunks from Saul's row. The SS guards turned away to play their lights up and down the center row of bunks. Red eyes reflected back like startled rats staring from half-opened coffins.
I will live.
When you look through the audio titles for Bram Stoker's Dracula, you'll find more than 30 selections. If you can believe this, some have been modernized with language the producers believe is more accessible. Excuse me, how's that for a ghoulish travesty? But fear not, fellow purists, I have found an abridged recording by Books in Motion, true to the original book, word for word. And what a story! If you've never read it, there's no time like the present. But perhaps not after sundown when the creatures roam the earth. The story begins with the journal of Jonathan Harker, a young solicitor on the way to Transylvania to inform the mysterious Count Dracula about his new estate in London. Dracula takes the young man prisoner. Jonathan witnesses many strange and evil things before his escape. He later decides he must have temporarily lost his mind. Meanwhile, back in England, Jonathan's fiancée, Minna, is visiting her friend Lucy. Lucy has just decided to marry, choosing the Honorable Arthur Holmwood over two other suitors, Dr. John Seward and Quincy Morris. Dracula, who has just come to London to feast on more humans, takes Lucy as his first victim. Dr. Seward, who, by coincidence, runs the insane asylum next door to Dracula's London home, tries to treat Lucy's illness. He calls in his friend and mentor, Professor Abraham Van Helsing, who recognizes what is wrong with Lucy, but cannot save her. Van Helsing sends out to convince the group about the realities of vampires and the danger of Dracula, who was, in his human life, a great warrior and thinker. They destroy the undead Lucy and set out to destroy Dracula himself. The title is performed by a wonderful cast with blood-curdling sound effects. Let's listen.
I had to hurry breakfast, for the train started a little before 8. Or rather, it ought to have done so. For after rushing to the station at 7:30, I had to sit in the carriage for more than an hour before we began to move. It seems to me that the further east you go, the more unpunctual are the trains. What ought they to be in China? All day long, we seemed to dawdle through a country which was full of beauty of every kind. Sometimes we saw little towns or castles on the top of steep hills, such as we see in old missals. Sometimes we ran by rivers and streams, which seemed, from the wide stony margin on each side of them, to be subject to great floods. It takes a lot of water, and running strong, to sweep the outside edge of a river clear. At every station, there were groups of people, sometimes crowds, and in all sorts of attire. Some of them were just like the peasants at home, or those I saw coming through France and Germany, with short jackets and round hats, homemade trousers. But others were very picturesque. The women looked pretty, except when you got near them, but they were very clumsy about the waist. They had all full white sleeves of some kind or other, and most of them had big belts with a lot of strips of something fluttering from them, like the dresses in a ballet. But, of course, there were petticoats under them. The strangest figures we saw were the Slovaks, who were more barbarian than the rest, with their big cowboy hats, great baggy, dirty white trousers, white linen shirts, and enormous, heavy leather belts, nearly a foot wide, all studded over with brass nails. They wore high boots, with their trousers tucked into them, and had long black hair and heavy black mustaches. They are very picturesque, but do not look prepossessing. On the stage, they would be set down at once as some old Oriental band of brigands. They are, however, I am told, very harmless and rather wanting in natural self-assertion. It was on the dark side of twilight when we got to Bistritz, which is a very interesting old place. Being practically on the frontier, for the Borgo Pass leads from it into Bukovina. It has had a very stormy existence, and it certainly shows marks of it. 50 years ago, a series of great fires took place, which made terrible havoc on 5 separate occasions. At the very beginning of the 17th century, it underwent a siege of 3 weeks and lost 13,000 people, the casualties of war proper being assisted by famine and disease. Count Dracula had directed me to go to the Golden Krona Hotel, which I found, to my great delight, to be thoroughly old-fashioned, for, of course, I wanted to see all I could of the ways of the country. I was evidently expected, for when I got near the door, I faced a cheery-looking elderly woman in the usual peasant dress, white undergarment with a long double apron, front and back, of colored stuff, fitting almost too tight for modesty. When I came close, she bowed and said,
"The Herr Englishman?"
"Yes, Jonathan Harker." She smiled and gave some message to an elderly man in white shirt sleeves who had followed her to the door. He went, but immediately returned with a letter.
"My friend, welcome to the Carpathians. I am anxiously expecting you. Sleep well tonight. At 3 tomorrow, the diligence will start for Bukovina. A place on it is kept for you. At the Borgo Pass, my carriage will await you and will bring you to me. I trust that your journey from London has been a happy one, and that you will enjoy your stay in my beautiful land. Your friend, Dracula."
4 May. I found that my landlord had got a letter from the Count directing him to secure the best place on the coach for me, but on making inquiries as to details, he seemed somewhat reticent and pretended that he could not understand my German. This could not be true, because up to then he had understood it perfectly. At least, he answered my questions exactly as if he did.
The Colonial Radio Theater performs The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, meticulously adapted from the book by Washington Irving. The acting, the sound effects, the music, and the terrifying final encounter with the Headless Horseman will be a Halloween favorite for your family. Jerry Robbins leads the narration.
"Not far from this village, perhaps about 2 miles, there is a little valley, or rather lap of land among high hills, which is one of the quietest places in the whole world. A small brook glides through it, with just murmur enough to lull one to repose. And the occasional whistle of a quail or tapping of a woodpecker is almost the only sound that ever breaks in upon the uniform tranquility. I recollect that when a stripling, my first exploit in squirrel shooting was in a grove of tall walnut trees that shades one side of the valley. I had wandered into it at noontime, when all nature is peculiarly quiet, and was startled by the roar of my own gun as it broke the Sabbath stillness around, and was prolonged and reverberated by the angry echo. If ever I should wish for a retreat whither I might steal from the world and its distractions and dream quietly away the remnant of a troubled life, I know of none more promising than this little valley. From the listless repose of the place and the peculiar character of its inhabitants, who are descendants from the original Dutch settlers, this sequestered glen has long been known by the name of Sleepy Hollow. And its rustic lads are called the Sleepy Hollow Boys throughout all the neighboring country. A drowsy, dreamy influence seems to hang over the land and to pervade the very atmosphere. Some say that the place was bewitched by a high German doctor during the early days of the settlement. Others, that an old Indian chief, the prophet or wizard of his tribe, held his powwows there before the country was discovered by Master Hendrik Hudson. Certain it is, the place still continues under the sway of some witching power. It holds a spell over the minds of the good people, causing them to walk in a continual reverie. They are given to all kinds of marvelous beliefs, are subject to trances and visions, and frequently see strange sights and hear music and voices in the air. The whole neighborhood abounds with local tales, haunted spots and twilight superstitions. Stars shoot and meteors glare oftener across the valley than in any other part of the country. And the nightmare, with her whole ninefold, seems to make it the favorite scene of her gambols. The dominant spirit, however, that haunts this enchanted region and seems to be commander-in-chief of all the powers of the air is the apparition of a figure on horseback without a head. It is said by some to be the ghost of a Hessian trooper whose head had been carried away by a cannonball in some nameless battle during the Revolutionary War, and who is ever and anon seen by the country folk hurrying along in the gloom of night as if on the wings of the wind. His haunts are not confined to the valley, but extend at times to the adjacent roads, and especially to the vicinity of a church at no great distance. Indeed, certain of the most authentic historians of those parts, who have been careful in collecting and collating the floating facts concerning this specter, allege that the body of the trooper having been buried in the churchyard. The ghost rides forth to the scene of battle in nightly quest of his head, and at the rushing speed by which he sometimes passes along the hollow like a midnight blast is owing to his being belated and in a hurry to get back to the churchyard before daybreak. Such is the general purport of this legendary superstition, which has furnished materials for many a wild story in that region of shadows. And the specter is known at all the country firesides by the name of the Headless Horseman of Sleepy Hollow. It is remarkable that the visionary propensity I have mentioned is not confined to the native inhabitants of the valley, but is unconsciously imbibed by everyone who resides there for a time, however wide awake they may have been before they entered that sleepy region. They are sure, in a little time, to inhale the witching influence of the air and begin to grow imaginative, to dream dreams, and see apparitions. I mention this peaceful spot with all possible laud, for it is in such little retired Dutch valleys found here and there embosomed in the great state of New York that population, manners, and custom remain fixed.
Readers, Halloween is such fun. It's easy to get into the spirit when you pick up one of these ghoulishly great titles. And when you are digging around for ideas on what to read next, look no further than my website, bookreportradio.com. Whatever your favorite genre, you'll find many literary treats there. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again next week on The Book Report.